number two, which is the open public input. We have five or six individuals. I think most of you understand how this works because most of you have done this before. But for those of you that haven't, you're given 3 minutes, and you'll hear a beep that will get a little bit louder, and that you can bring your comments to a close there. Spend an extra 5 or 10 seconds if needed, but please do bring your comments to a close at that point. I will call you up at two at a time, and just keep it rotating out. So Robert Elverson and Donnie Jackson, please. Give them to Tammy. So, Robert, it's all yours.
So, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the time this morning. My name is Bob Alverson, and I represent Fishing Vessel Owners Association out of Seattle. The handout I had was needed to be handed out, so I was wondering if it could be handed out to the commissioners. I'm going to be speaking from the right side of the folder. I am with the Fishing Vessel Owners Association, which is a trade association of hook and line boats that fish for halibut and blackcod out of the state of Washington. We represent about 95 fishing families, and I also wear a hat of as an international halibut commissioner. I'll be speaking this morning as the executive director for FVOA. You have an agenda item at 11:05 dealing with the Bering Sea bycatch on halibut, and so that's kind of what this is focused on, to give you a briefing on. This first page on the right-hand side represents all the regulatory areas that the commission manages at this time, and those little dots you see there are where the survey stations are that are conducted on an annual basis to determine the abundance of the resource. There's about 16 boats that participate annually in those surveys, and over the last the next page shows sort of the last 20-year history of where the resource is, and perhaps you caught all the news last June when the bycatch problem that the North Pacific Council was addressing. The resource has significantly gone through a reduction. Some of that is due to poor year class strengths. We've had about 12 years where we've not had a really great year class strength. And back in the 1990s, the North Pacific Council established a hard trawl bycatch cap on halibut in the Bering Sea districts. And it was not an abundance-based cap. It was a fixed cap, and it seemed to work at that time with the abundance of the resource. But as the resource has come down and that cap has stayed static, it has created a problem. And one of the problems is the bycatch in the Bering Sea is significantly juvenile halibut. And the art of the problem there is that the factor trawlers target yellowfin sole and rock sole, and in amongst that is this juvenile halibut area, and it's just north of the peninsula there, the western peninsula. It's called a closed area. That closed area is for hook and line boats, not the trawl fleet. But the art is trying to get fish that live 20 and 50 years old, protect them while still extracting fish that have a life cycle of maybe 10 to 12 years. That'd be the yellowfin sole and rock sole. So that's what the North Pacific Council was addressing. The next page reflects where the abundance of halibut has been. And the last series I was going to address where the North Pacific Council and the Halibut Commission were headed to address this problem.
Thank you. Chairman. Any questions? Mr. Q?
Go ahead, Bob.
Thanks, Bob, for coming all the way down from Seattle. Appreciate your time to come down here. Kind of got cut off a little the bit. I would like you to, and just so the commissioners know, we're going to get a briefing by Bill Twite, who is Washington's representative on the North Pacific Council, which is a federal body set up under the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And you know, Bob has been very active on this issue on behalf of his organization. So maybe if you don't mind, could you just kind of frame the issue that was confronted by the North Pacific Council as it relates to the halibut bycatch in the Bering Sea?
Right. two years ago, the Halibut Commission surveys came back, and their numbers were significantly down in the Bering Sea districts. And we were going to have to reduce the quota to a point where the directed fishery would be basically dysfunctional. It's a quota share program, and the quotas would be so far down that it would not make sense to hire a crew, have a boat, and go fishing. While at the same time, you have this static bycatch cap for the trawl fleet of about, I think it's 3,700 tons of bycatch. And so the commission told the North Pacific Council, we have a problem. We may have to shut down the directed fishery, and we need some help with your bycatch, because the North Pacific Council manages the bycatch side of this resource. And in terms of the numbers. And so there was a an action in June in the North Pacific Council. We had hoped that the council had take a more aggressive reduction. They voted for a net reduction of about 17%, and that became effective just last week through the National Marine Fishery Service. And so it'll be effective for this year. One of the big components of that is to try to get these juvenile halibut overboard while they're still alive. And you would think, well, that's sort of a logical thing to do. But our National Marine Fisheries Service felt it was more important to count the fish, so they forced the trawlers to have the fish go into the bunkers of the trawler, and then, they suffocate and die by the time they get counted. So the new art is to what they call deck sorting. And this increases the survivability up to 60%. So if you can jettison the fish over in the first half hour after a big bag of fish comes up on one of these trawlers, they have a very high survivability. So half of the factory trawler fleet is participated in this action last year, and almost all of them will participate now through what they call an experimental fishing permit during the 2016 season. And it looks like it was very successful for 2015, and so the commission was able to provide a higher catch limit for 2015, and it will probably be a very similar harvest level next year in the Bering Sea for the directed fishery. But the next 3 years are going to be very critical in monitoring what success there is in this deck sorting. And I'm really happy that some of your commissioners were interested and asked this to be on the agenda, because it's very important for the state of Washington and the resource overall.
I just have one follow-up, and then I'll be done. So, thanks, Bob, for that. And then I just wanted to ask you, and you kind of alluded to it, what issues do you think the commission should monitor and provide, you know, guidance to the director, to the state? I do know that this is, you know, the director, it's within the director's discretion, but still, certainly the commission can provide guidance on issues. What issues do you believe that the commission should be monitoring and watching and asking questions as we move forward in this process?
Through the chair, the importance of those small halibut in the Bering Sea, Bob, I think the second to the last paper I put out here is a tagging, shows the tagging results of those fish. These juveniles at about age 3, 4, and 5 rotate out of the Southern Bering Sea, and they migrate to the east, and they backfill all the way down to Northern California. And some of these fish have been tagged, and 9 months later, this one on the southern part of Nia Bay there, from the time it was tagged to the time it ended up at Nia Bay was 9 months. And so they get a little motor in there, and they take off. So there's an importance there, and I think the important part for this commission, your commission, is to maybe this time of year ask for someone from the International Halibut Commission or someone like myself to come down and just give a review of where we're at on our bycatch and where we're at on our resource. All the bycatch information is compiled by the National Marine Fisheries Service and the Halibut Commission by late December. And, of course, the Halibut Commission usually has their meeting in late January. So we would have all the data for you on an annual basis, both on bycatch and where the resource looks like it's going.
That's a good idea. Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, nice to see you again. I think I've seen you in meetings for going on several decades now.
Yeah, I don't know if we want to talk about that.
No, we don't. I don't want to change subjects, but I want to change species for a moment. I think it was about a decade ago, if I'm right, and please correct me, that there were some issues with Chinook bycatch up in the Bering Sea. Can you address the trends of that, what's been done, and how you see that working?
Well, I wish halibut had the image of Chinook salmon in Alaska, but Chinook salmon bycatch is a hot button in Alaska, and the last 3 out of 5 years, there's been reductions and more sophisticated restrictions on the trawl fleet. They have a very tight number, and it got up as high, I think, as 60 or 70,000 Chinook about 7-8 years ago, and I think they've been down around 5 to 10,000 the last 3 to 5 years. And they have when I say they, I'm talking about the factory trawl fleet has a very sophisticated process of getting their observer data, and they have many of them have two observers on them. They have no less than at least one observer on them, and that data is compiled daily by both the National Marine Fisheries Service and private organizations hired by the factory trawler fleet to tell them when they are in high concentrations of any of the types of salmon. Chum salmon is another hot button up there, but they've done the same thing, by the way, Mr. Carpenter, in the Gulf of Alaska as well. Very tight restrictions, and they seem to be working. They seem to be working well.
Thank you.
Mr. Walker.
Well, you've presented us with some very interesting information, and I don't know that much about these fisheries, but I'm very interested, and I agree with Commissioner Kehoe. If there's anything that we can do to signal our support for the interests of the Washington fisheries, certainly keep coming to us and let us know how we can help. Just looking at this table one, comparison of biomass or the median population and fishing intensity estimates, that just looking at it looks like a poorly managed fishery to me. It looks like it's subject to intense effort with a declining spawning population, exploitable biomass. So that gives me concern about how we're managing, how whoever's managing it is managing it. But I did have another just minor question. Maybe it's not minor. I see that sablefish mainly exported to Asia. I love sablefish. Why is it not more available in Washington State? Why is it, if it's a price deal, why isn't there just more marketing?
Through the chair, two issues. One on the biomass stuff. I don't know if I indicated. In the last 3 years, the commission has reduced the directed fishing by 60% and 70% in different regulatory areas. And this year, if you look at one of the charts there, it does look like we've hit bottom. And the resource is responding to that positive management. And you're right, there was too much fish being taken out for about 7-8 years in a row. And that's helped drive the decline. With regards to sablefish, our organization is probably half of our income is based on sablefish off the coast of Washington, Oregon, as well as in Alaska. And it's been an export item originally to Asia, primarily Japan. And it was almost 90%. In the last 5 years, it's probably 75% exported. There are more restaurants, and it's an effort by the processors to not be so dependent upon the yen and the Chinese yuan issues, because you can't control your profits. Whereas if you, the more you can consume in your own domestic market, you don't have that variability. So there is an incentive to push this, but it's not something that's going to end up, it's probably going to be a white tablecloth item because it's so expensive. And so that's where it's being targeted right now in the United States.
Well, I just would mention Costco sells halibut, and it's expensive. I think what I've seen is it's about the same as halibut, maybe a little bit more. So I think there's marketing opportunities.
There's one market opportunity.
Yeah. Thank you.
Better get her a box.
Well, I noticed, Mr. Chairman, when the price went up, I stopped getting free fish at the office. So.
Tilapia.
Yeah, tilapia.
Thank you, Bob.
Okay.
Thank you. Milton Gudgell, please, and Donnie.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, and the Department of Wildlife. My name is Donnie Jackson, and I live in a place called Starbucks, about 30 miles down the Toucannon River from your Wooten Game Range. And the reason I'm here today, I'm having a terrible time with coyotes killing my calves. I raise wheat and cattle around Starbucks. Past year, I've lost 14 calves and one cow that I know of that coyotes have killed. And that comes to about $28,000. It's a pretty good chunk of money to me. Last year, I contacted a department to see if they could help me out any of my problem, and I was told the department has nothing to do with coyotes anymore. They're not responsible for anything that coyotes do. I had to go to USDA to get any help, which I did, and a nice young fellow from Moses Lake came over and met with me. And they have three things they can do to help me out. They can have a guy come out at night, call him in and try to shoot him. That costs me $50 an hour. They can have a fixed-winged airplane. That costs me $130 an hour. Or they can get a helicopter. That's $550 an hour. So I said, okay, let's try the airplane. Well, he said, we've got a problem. We haven't had a pilot for 2 years, so we can't use that. I said, how about the helicopter? Well, he said, we don't have one. We borrowed one from Idaho last year for 6 hours, and that's all we could get it for. So I gave him $500, and they had a guy come out at night and tried to shoot him, and he got one, which I was grateful. At least he got one anyway for $500. I have seven different sportsmen's groups, different people in there trying to shoot these coyotes. They're trying calling them in and what have you. And they've killed two so far. I have a friend in Oregon that has a plane, and he shoots a lot of coyotes in Oregon. He doesn't need a permit. He doesn't need any. He just goes out and helps these ranchers out shooting coyotes for them. And he's willing to bring his plane up and do it for me for nothing. But before he can do that, I have to have a permit from the Department of Wildlife to do this. After 3 weeks of trying to get a permit, I was told that I cannot get a permit because it might offend the environmentalists. Well, my farming and ranching, I mean, that's nothing new. I probably offend environmentalists every day. That's no, I mean, that's just the way life is. But I bet if you take $28,000 out of some of these environmentalists' bank account, I bet you a dollar to a donut, they'd squeal like a stuck pig because they wouldn't stand for that. So. But it's fine if I lose that kind of money. The department says they have no responsibility for coyotes. Before I can go out and shoot a coyote, I have to go buy a hunting license. I have a son in Oregon. He would come up and help me shoot him if he could. He has to buy an out-of-state license, which is pretty expensive for him. I can't have a loaded gun in my vehicle. If you ever tried to shoot a coyote, you're driving down the road and you've got your gun set and there's no shells in it. You see a coyote, time you get out and get your gun loaded and get ready, he's off in the other county. I mean, you've lost him. I'm not saying I pack a loaded gun in my vehicle, but it sure helps. I mean, it does. To snare him, I have to get a permit to snare him. Last time it took me over a month to get a permit to snare him. If I trap him, I have to have a license. I'm sure of that. I'm positive I have to have a license. To get a trapping license, I have to go to the school to get that. I mean, you can't have it both ways. And the reason I'm here today, I'm asking, is there anything the commission do to help me out on this? I don't know if you can or not, but if you do, I'd sure appreciate it. You know, in 1989, I was the first one in the state of Washington. I'm sorry, a truck tire blew up in my ear yesterday, and I can't hear very well. Can I get just two more statements, and I'll be done?
That's fine.
In 1989, I was the first one in the state of Washington to receive the Landowner of the Year Award from the department. That year, I kept track of how many people I had hunting on the land that I owned and I leased. And it was almost 1,100 people, over 1,000, almost 1,100 that hunted on my land. And I might say, with hardly any problem at all from any of them. Our home place has been in our family now for 99 years, and it's never been closed to hunting or fishing. And I'll tell you, the Department of Wildlife is making it pretty tough to keep my land open. I'll do anything I can to keep it open, but boy, it's getting tough to do. I thank you for hearing me out, and if you can help me any, I'd sure appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Commissioner.
There again, about three weeks ago, I became aware of Mr. Jackson's problem and had the opportunity and pleasure to get to speak with him two or three times on the phone. Those of you who Starbucks about a dot on a road map about like Anatone, he lives about an hour closer to Vancouver than what I do, but still, for this man to take the time, the money, and the effort to drive clean down here, I hope we can come up with an answer. I had the opportunity to talk to Mick.
Mr. Jackson, why don't you come back up?
Yeah, okay. You sure it's safe to do this?
I'll keep the gavel away.
All right, you watch him.
I did have the opportunity to talk to Mick Cope, and I can definitely see where the department's hands are somewhat tied on this issue, and especially with the wolf issue in play. But, there again, I'd mentioned Francine earlier, and when she made her presentation, you get to the point in time that you just feel frustrated, and pretty quick people are striking out and doing not so good things. And like Donnie said, the number of calves he's lost, we were on an all-time high a year ago. Now it's gone down, so they're not worth quite so much, but that becomes a double-edged sword because now all of a sudden our margins are thinner. So a death loss is more important, actually, now. So, it's a tough deal. And I just hate to see when people that have been law-abiding all their lives get shoved into bad situations because he's got to protect his livelihood. So hopefully we can come up with some kind of a solution to help Mr. Jackson out.
Thank you, Commissioner. Joe, did you want to chime in on anything?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't have the details in terms of the regulatory framework, but we could ask Nate to come up and maybe give you a little bit of background in terms of the situation we're in.
I think that would,
Sorry, Nate, to put you on the spot.
Gonna have a crowded table, gentlemen. Good morning. Commissioners, Nate Pamplin, Assistant Director with the Wildlife Program. Commissioner Holzmiller had given me a call. I believe he visited with Steve Pazangra and with Mick Cope, looking at the situation. It's my understanding, as Mr. Jackson outlined, he's looking for a permit to do aerial coyote control. And so that's something that we have not regulated. We have, in certain circumstances, have USDA is the entity that does that. They are on a fee schedule where the landowners pay them to do that, as Mr. Jackson outlined. So that's not something that we have authorized in the past. I think folks would be very understanding of the associated controversy with that action, but I also understand and very sympathetic to what Mr. Jackson's describing. So Happy to visit with Mr. Jackson, try to take a look at the where there is some sort of wiggle room. What are those? He outlined a number of other tools, and there was some barriers there towards implementation, and would like to investigate, get curious about those, see if we can't streamline and provide some better service there.
Thank you, Nate. Commissioner Carpenter, can you just...
Thank you. I would expect that... any of us that would have incur those kind of economic losses would, in a pretty short timeline, figure out a way to resolve those. And I would expect that Mr. Jackson has probably paid his share of taxes over the course of his lifetime. And I think that there, I don't expect we can come up with something today, but I think we need to come up with something to address this, maybe in a briefing in February, because it's an unreasonable thing to tell a man that's been doing what he's doing his whole career, that he's got to go beg U.S. Fish and Wildlife or USDA to come out and shoot coyotes from an airplane when it may be next year, it may be too late. It's not a logical scenario, and I think we need to address it.
Commissioner Grable?
I'm not sure, but with the fires that we had in eastern Washington and the loss of habitat and other things, I think that we may see a spike in predation on calves this year, too, in that region. So it's an issue that probably goes beyond Donnie's situation and is worth investigation, because we may have to respond to the same circumstances in other regions of the state. And I agree, this issue needs to be addressed fairly quickly, because when does your calving begin, Donnie?
I've been calving year-round. We have a beef co-op. We need calves year-round, so I've been calving year. So it's a problem all year for me.
All right.
It really is.
Okay, so the sooner the better is what you're telling me.
I'm calving quite a few of them right now, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So but I think it may be beyond his singular issue to investigate.
Thank you. Mr. Thorburn?
Well, I would just like to add my voice of support for looking for a solution to this. I am familiar with the situation in Lincoln County and hearing the same sorts of things from the ranchers there. The number of calves that are being taken by coyotes, the population is way out of control, is increasing year by year. I also had some experience of dealing with USDA and trying to get the helicopter in, and can second what you've learned about it. It's really, really difficult to work with USDA just because they're short on resources, and it's very difficult to get the helicopter or a plane or anything. Ground hunting is pretty unsuccessful, as he's talked about. And I think that perhaps it's an issue of messaging in terms of changing the department's response to this. Coyotes are they're way out of control. The population continues to increase because we don't have any predators for coyotes. We're the predators, and I think we just need to get the word out that it's very harmful to rural populations at this point.
Well said. Thank you.
Okay. And I'm not sure you want the predators that prey on coyotes coming to your plate, but they might be on their way. I don't know. I'm not sure that would help you. But I would suggest you've been good enough in your life and career to allow people to hunt on your property, and I don't know if that's deer hunters or bird hunters or whatever, but I'm involved with a lot of hunters, and my friends hunt, and most of them that like to hunt deer like to hunt coyotes in the winter or off-season, and you had a lot of people you've allowed to hunt on your property, and maybe somehow getting back to those folks, and maybe you've tried, but you know, a condition to hunt next year is that you come out and help me with some legal coyote hunting. And I'd put you in touch with the Mueller Foundation director out of Spokane. His name's Dan McKinley. You can look him up and call him, and you know, he puts stuff out on the websites, and people would respond to that, I bet, to help you out. So,
thank you.
If you don't mind, thank you. And we are blessed in our part of the world with Scott Raisley and Jason Earle. We've got two really good animal damage people, and there's no reason that, I mean, my point of view, that we can't put Scott out there to kind of monitor the thing. I mean, Donnie isn't a Yahoo in the first place. He would do it right. But the way he led me to believe it was a pretty good chunk of ground that's pretty well squared off, wouldn't be out on the neighbors, wouldn't be out here, there, or the other. And with Scott kind of monitoring, I think it should be a workable deal. Thank you.
Any last thoughts? I hope we've given you a bit of optimism on that, that you've gotten our attention, and working with Nate and the rest of us, I think we will do our very best to help you out, sir.
I thank each one of you, and if you can't help me, you've sure made me feel better. I'll say that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Lee Blankenship, please, and Milton.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Milton Gudgell. I own Pacific Salmon Charters at the mouth of the Columbia River. In referring back to part of Brad's comments earlier about license sales, well, part of it is because we don't know when the season is. Right now, we're coming on to a sturgeon fishery. Nobody knows. I just came from Billings, Montana, on a sports show. I had must have had 500 people there want to know about sturgeon. This week, right now, we're going to show in Tri-Cities. Next week, we'll be in Puyallup. Nobody knows. We need to have a decision made if we're going to have a season no later than January 30th. Those people you were talking about buying licenses, they can't make a plan. They go north. Canada's great. Alaska's great. They can make plans for that. So we need to make a decision if we're going to have it or not have it. I would even give you another 30 days to figure out the details of the season, size limits, whatever, days of the week. And by the way, if we're going to continue with hook and release, it's nothing but a license for poachers. And the size limits need to be consistent up and down the river. There's no reason that the people in the upper river below Bonneville can take sublegal fish, and the ones down below, you can't. It needs to be consistent up and down the river. That's my first item. The second one is lingcod. We fish for halibut out of the mouth of the Columbia River, and for some reason, we can't keep lingcod while we're halibut fishing. We're not married to Oregon. When we fish there, we should be very able to keep them. Westport can keep them. Why? If they can keep them, why can't we? There's no valid reason. They can't pin it on yellow eyes, and you can't pin it on enforcement. And get it done. Make a decision, please. It doesn't have to wait till the end of February or March or April. You can get it done now. What you did last year with the sturgeon fishery was unforgivable to your constituents. You can't do that. The third reason, the thing I want to talk about today, is bear. We have an overabundance of bear on the Long Beach Peninsula. WDF gets lots of calls about bears. They're garbage bears. That's what they do. They dig in the garbage. The county's come down and cleaned up one mess on my own street, and it was bad. There's no reason why we can't bend the rules a bit. They live on a narrow strip of land about 10 miles long from a quarter to half a mile wide. The owner, you can't, it's all private property. You can't hunt them with a rifle. You can't shoot from the road because your guns are not loaded, right? So we need some help. The only solution I have for bears is either WDF enforcement personnel are going to have to get off their stick and start live trapping them. Don't move them. Get rid of them, because you can't rehabilitate a garbage bear. Either that, or give those of us that are mostly affected by that permits to bait from tree stands and get rid of them. It won't take very long. I would suggest that you do this at least for 1 year, starting this spring. That's the extent of my comments today. If you have any questions about those, fire away.
Thank you, Milton. Any questions from the commission? Yes.
Well, I don't have a question. Thanks, Milt, for coming. I have talked with him a couple times in the last month and referred his points to staff. So I think they're on it. Darn. They're working on it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think maybe I address this question to Guy. I look at tomorrow on item 11, 1045, Lower Columbia River Sturgeon Population Status and Management Annual Review Briefing and Public Comment. I mean, I guess I'm wondering why we couldn't add to that in a decision. Your thoughts on that? I think Mr. Gudgell's comments about letting people know what we can and can't do, what our intent is, has some value.
Go ahead.
Chairman Smith, Commissioner Carpenter, the agenda item tomorrow is specifically for reviewing the status of sturgeon. Once again, we have what looks like a very robust legal population, but there's other indicators that, like juvenile recruitment, that are of cause of concern. Last year, we entertained a very small fishery that we thought could be consistent with our conservation objective with the commission policy. We need to coordinate with Oregon as well in terms of making a decision whether we move forward with a conservation-based fishery or not, a retention fishery. I think that certainly part of the presentation tomorrow could include a question to the commission, whether the commission would support going to Oregon to discuss a potential fishery or not. So I think we can certainly pose that question in tomorrow's agenda item.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
When do we make a decision with Oregon, typically? And why does it take so long?
So in past years, Commissioner Wecker, when we did have consistent retention fisheries, we typically made the season decisions in the first commission meeting in January, and then move forward with a compact hearing in late January to actually set the seasons. Last 2 years, of course, we've had no retention, and so we've been in a different mode. Last year, when we discussed the fishery, it was following the North of Falcon process, and so a little different kind of a planning process when we've been in a two-year moratorium. I think that if indeed the commission wanted us to go forward with a discussion about a conservation-based fishery, we would try and have those conversations with Oregon ASAP, probably by next month, and try and come back with something, within the next couple months to look at a fishery. In the past, the fisheries have been year-round. I would assume if indeed both commissions were interested in entertaining a conservation fishery, it would be a reduced seasonal fishery that could be entertained later in the year. So not quite as critical to set a season in January as it was in the past when we had year-round seasons, but as Mr. Gudgell indicates, for the industry to plan, it does make some sense to make a decision as soon as possible.
Any further? Yes, I'm sure.
This probably would be a question better kept till tomorrow, but I'm still going forward. I'd like to be able to sort this through in my mind. Needless to say, there's a lot of population down this part of the world, so the sports fishery, I'm sure, has its effect upon the sturgeon. But, well, it's going to be a tough one for you to answer. Don't try and put a number to it. But the marine mammals are definitely having an impact on the sturgeon, right?
Commissioner Holzmiller, we are concerned about increased predation by stellar sea lions on sturgeon. There's some information that the Army Corps of Engineers has put together, observations just below Bonneville Dam, increased numbers of stellars progressively in the last few years, and they are predating on sturgeon. As I mentioned earlier, we've got positive indicators and negative indicators on the sturgeon population. One of the negative indicators that we can't put a number on directly is the concern about the increase of predation by stellar sea lions. So there's a that's definitely a concern. One of the things on the positive side that I would at least speculate on is the fact that we've had a recovery of the smelt population in the last 3 years, and many of these sea lions are now predating on smelt. So I'm hopeful that the fact that they've got another prey base, that does reduce some of the targeting of sturgeon, but definitely a continued concern.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mel. Yes.
I'd like to follow up. The increase in legal-sized sturgeon is not an increase. That's just the sublegals have grown up. There aren't any more sturgeon. That's what that is. And I might make a suggestion for Guy. If you're going to have a fishery, and it's going to be a conservative, yes, hopefully, then leave out Saturdays. If you don't, you cannot maintain your counts and the information that you need, because there are too many people going on the weekends. One weekend day is fine, but two, you're going to have an accounting of your fish somehow. Aerial flights don't do it.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Sean Cantrell and Lee.
Commissioners, Director Enders, appreciate the opportunity for a brief statement. By means of introduction, my name is Lee Blankenship. I'm retired from WDFW about 10 years ago. I currently serve as vice chair for the Hatchery Scientific Review Group, or HSRG, for the Hatchery Reform Project. I'm here today to report on an encouraging development with respect to some tribal and overlapping tribal-state HGMPs, or hatchery genetic management plans. As you're aware, federal law requires you have approved HGMPs under ESA. Coastwide, there are about almost 400 HGMPs. Only about 13% of those have been approved by NOAA, and that's 210 haven't even been submitted or they've been deemed insufficient scientifically. Last fall, NOAA said it takes 18 months to approve one HGMP. In Puget Sound, we have one person working on HGMPs. Hatchery production is at risk from third-party litigation, as you're well aware of, and it's for two reasons. The process, HGMPs haven't been approved, or they're not scientifically defensible. The successful lawsuits by the Wild Fish Conservancy should be a surprise to no one. On a positive note, three northern Puget Sound tribes, the Upper Skagit, the Tulalips, and the Lummies, approached the HSRG asking for help to make their HGMP scientifically defensible. We were very pleased to do this and surprised. 2 years ago, if you asked me, would this happen, I would have been said no. I would have been shocked. So it's very encouraging to work with these tribes and work. So they really ran a risk. They need to be rewarded for their actions because they're being criticized by a lot of other tribes. The end result, however, of working with the HSRG, they just submitted their HGMPs a few months ago. They received a letter of sufficiency from NOAA in record time. While this isn't final approval, it might be sufficient to avoid a successful lawsuit. On a negative point, NOAA isn't scheduled to do a final review on these same HGMPs until 2017. The reason is some time ago the department and Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission met and put out a schedule of which HGMPs they wanted reviewed in such and such an order. Remember, it takes 18 months to do one. The northern tribes weren't even involved in this process, and consequently, their HGMPs, although scientifically defensible, won't be reviewed for some time. I'm here today on behalf of those three northern tribes and the HSRG requesting the commission and the department to consider meeting with Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission again and with consideration of moving those HGMPs that have been reviewed by an independent scientific review group ahead of the process because they're ready to go. It won't take 18 months on these, as we've seen. Bob Turner from NOAA has said he'll follow any prioritization process that he gets. On a final note, the tribes, recreational community, and the HSRG received, went to Congress, told this story, got $4 million for the state, the tribes, and NOAA to speed up the process. We recently did the same thing with WFW staff to the governor, encouraging matching funds and a look at reprioritizing these statements. So I'm here to ask for your help.
Thank you, Lee. Any questions? Mr. Mankin.
No, I don't have a question except to say that thank you for what the HSRG has been doing. I think that this is going to be the wave of the future with the scientific backdrop for getting the HGMPs done. And I'm particularly interested and pleased with the fact that we have now have some of our co-managers, the tribes, working with us on this, because I don't think that this is going to get done unless we have that kind of close cooperation. And thank you.
I totally agree, Commissioner Mankin.
Mr. Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lee, thank you for the report. I've been tracking this as well, I guess probably because of where I live. But I fully support suggesting that the agency follow your comments and see if we can't reprioritize the ones that are ready to go. Politics aside, we need to get these things done to protect ourselves against legal action.
Yeah, Mr. Wicker.
I just want to thank Lee for coming here and bringing this very, very important topic to us. This is a monumentally important topic. I mean, this is our fisheries that's at stake now, and it sounds like a huge problem that the federal government doesn't have the resources to process the paperwork that needs to be processed or the scientific capacity. I mean, we're in a bottleneck situation here with an enormously valuable fishery. This is so big and so important to the department that I think we need to hear the big picture of what's happening. And I really encourage the director to give us a report every single month that we meet on the status, the progress, to try to bring the resources to bear, because now we have a lawsuit in the Columbia River. And that is going to burden NOAA even more. They'll have to devote some of their resources to that region now. So this is huge. This is gigantic in terms of priorities.
Mr. Thornburg.
I can't help but interject a little politics. I think I heard from you that it might be a good message to other co-managers if we supported the particular cooperative co-managers to maybe be a little less leery of the HSRG and assist their help. So I think that's another reason that it would be useful for us to assist.
Thank you, Lee.
You're all said and taken to heart.
Travis Buck, please, and Sean.
Good morning, Chairman. My name is Sean Cantrell. I'm the Northwest Regional Director for Defenders of Wildlife. I want to touch briefly on two topics during this session. One is the State Wildlife Action Plan, or SWAP, which you'll be getting a briefing on, and the other is very briefly the Wolf Advisory Group, which has already been mentioned this morning. Regarding the SWAP, the department staff has done a great job in developing this plan. It provides a valuable snapshot of the current situation of where we are, also allows for a contrast for the last time it was there, and it also helps sets the benchmark for measuring progress or challenges as we go forward when it gets reviewed again, so that we can kind of learn our lessons and know where we're making progress and where we're not. We particularly commend WFW for also going one step further than a lot of the other states do when they develop their swaps, in that this WFW looks at the current level of investment in the various species and the challenges facing those species and where there are sufficient or insufficient. And not a lot of states do that. So I think that is a really admirable piece that you as commissioners should recognize is a fairly unique thing that WFW does. And it's a really helpful For those of us on the outside, if there's places where we can partner and seeing where resources are needed, or if we can help talk to appropriators at the state or federal level to help get more resources for these critical species needs. So that's a real valuable piece of what the department has done. Regarding the Wolf Advisory Group, or WAG, I know that you heard from Donnie Martorello and Francine Madden at your December meeting, and by all accounts, it sounds like it was great. Commissioner Holtzmiller talked about meeting with Francine afterwards. And as a member of the WAG, I just want to tell you that the 17 of us really value what the process is going on, and thank you as commissioners for supporting that process. We feel like we're making real progress, both in the dialogue amongst the stakeholders at the table, but also real-world differences on the ground, both for livestock operators as well as for wolf and wolf advocates. At the December meeting, which took place after you all met with Francine, I feel like we made some major steps and breakthroughs, and I know Commissioner Caney and Thornburn were both there and may have reported to you already, but I'd be happy to share my observations and thoughts about where we are and what those really valuable decisions that we reached at the December meeting. And again, it's a process. We've got a lot more to go. Just the WAG process, I think, really is helping transform the conflict, which is really the intent. And so just encourage you to continue your support for the process and the staff in making this happen. The last note that I would make this morning is that you will hear from the director in his report the training that many of the WFW staff went through with Francine on the conflict transformation. And I think that's an incredibly valuable tool that she is helping provide the department, not just for wolf issues, but for a variety of things, whether it be coyotes and how to deal with those sorts of issues or anything else. So wanted to make sure that you understand that the participants, conservation groups, livestock operators, hunters, general public that are part of that process, all are feeling very positive about it and thankful that we have this opportunity. So thank you,
Sean. Questions? Comments? Mr. Keeney?
Thank you, Sean, for saying that. And it kind of, I remember a few things I wanted to mention on that, but that the WAG meeting that we attended was just so well run. And I think some of the other things that this facilitator is doing, you know, we hoped as a commission that this would help this process, and I'm glad to hear you say it is. I think what I saw, it really is. And the department also took a lot of flack over the price tag for this person. And I think what I think people are starting to see is there's all of a variety of facilitators, but this person is highly trained in conflict resolution worldwide. And we're getting some real expert advice that I think, and Jay might talk to this too, but I mean, everybody's saying like, oh, okay, we get it now. We needed a lot of help and we're getting it. And we're getting through some things. She's doing a lot of trainings outside of the Wolf Advisory Group for department staff. And I heard from several people that said it was pretty amazing some of the things that, you know, she was getting across in terms of principles that can help us as a state not only get through wolf conflict issues but other issues of conflict. So really pleased to have you here and hear what you had to say.
Thanks.
Anything else? Thanks, Sean. Travis, you bring up the caboose here.
All right. I got a couple pictures. Can I give them to you guys? Where? Okay. I kind of wanted to have you take a look at them. They're part of my discussion. They're the same thing, so. The reason I came is I own property on the Klamath River. I've got 1,200 feet of riverfront down there, and over the last several years, repeatedly, as part of the nutrient enrichment program, they're taking salmon carcasses and dumping them up on Gobar Creek and other locations. Well, my problem is with the way it's being done. We actually have some guidelines on how it's supposed to be implemented. The reason I hadn't actually even looked up the guidelines, I wasn't really prepared for this. I only found out about the meeting yesterday from a friend that's in the in the Water Conservation District. And the problem that I have with those photographs, and they've always rubbed me wrong until I started doing a little research, is that if you notice that the fish are all dumped in a big, huge pile over the edge of the bridge. They're not strung out down the stream bed like they're supposed to be. If you actually calculate that out by the organic loading from that pile, it far exceeds the loading for that entire stream. If you... do the calculations. I pulled them up today, and we have a this is from your guys' own guidelines. It says target level is 0.0063 kilograms per square meter of nutrient enrichment there. We're way beyond that. The reason I actually even started thinking about it when I noticed the what was going on several years ago is I'm in wastewater. I'm a licensed wastewater treatment system designer. When you put that much organic loading in a specific place, you decrease the dissolved oxygen in the water by the process that takes place. Number two, when you put that much organic loading in a specific spot, you start the processes of decomposition there. And with it being piled up on the shoulders of the root stream as well as in the stream, the stuff on the shoulders starts to break down and we get all kinds of really nasty pathogens, bacteria, contaminating the water stream all the way down through there. We create a public health threat. I guess that's really the reason I've come today. And then my other frustration with regards to the Klam River in particular is with the new salmon traps, the way they were implemented this last year. I own, like I said, I do have a dog in the fight. I own 1,200 feet of riverfront. I have my own lock on a Weyerhaeuser gate. I drive down 3 miles down to the river. I've set it up where I've got campsites, all kinds of stuff. I take Boy Scouts in there and let them use it free of charge. And I go up every summer or every fall and I teach them how to fish and I work with them. Well, this last fall, because of the way the program was implemented, we had virtually, I mean, I've been told that they allowed hatchery fish to go up. I catch somewhere between catch and release, somewhere around 200 to 300 fish a fall. I do catch and release a pile. I'm really just in it for fishing. I love fishing. Last year on the Klamath River up in my stretch of the river, we're on an average season. Take out the year before when the traps were out, when I could go up and catch 10 to 15 fish a day on, you know, legitimately fishing. Last year I caught 5 native salmon, and that was it in the entire fall season up through there. That not only takes money out of the community by, if you went up last year, I actually drifted the river and the fish counters came down. We ended up with very few fishermen above the traps. It was elbow to elbow below the traps with people snagging, with all kinds of problems. I didn't even want to be down there. I completely avoided that set stretch. I actually kind of retaught myself, which I didn't enjoy, how to fish down in the tidewater on the outgoing tide with bait so that I could still fish the river that I love fishing and actually produce fish. Okay, go ahead.
No.
Oh. Oh, sorry. But
my hand signals.
Okay. But yeah, so that's the main reason I'm here. I have no problem. I don't know if I put my number on there. I have no problem volunteering and gathering a few people to volunteer time to do the nutrient enrichment because I think the program as it's outlined is very, very valuable. We need it. But as it's being implemented, and this isn't the first year this has happened. This has happened year after year after year after year. What happens, I would guarantee if you actually took a dissolved oxygen sample from the water below that area, you would find that your dissolved oxygen levels are to the point where they're actually killing habitat, not helping it. So that, I guess that's why I'm here.
Thank you, Travis. So, questions from the commission?
Go for it. Yes. Who is doing this distribution of these carcasses
this
right now?
This is coming from the salmon traps. So this is their getting rid of their
this
excess.
This is Department of Fish and Wildlife.
This is Department of Fish and Wildlife, yeah. As far as I know.
No, I know these enrichment programs are really important.
They're very important.
And, I'm disappointed to see this. I believe the CCA and some other organizations actually use, wood chippers to grind up the carcasses so they distribute
better.
Yeah,
and that way there they don't decompose and cause pathogens and other things in the water that we don't want there.
Right.
That's definitely not what's going on there. That picture was taken last year by a friend of mine.
Okay, so, and you say this has been going on since the traps have been
it's been going on in previous years. Last year they didn't get the traps in because of basically timeline with getting their permits through to get them done. And coincidentally, I actually went down and talked to the federal people down there when they were getting ready to do it. I was actually working at the water treatment plant at the time, right below the traps. And they had some input, which is completely different with the way that things are being done. So
yeah, there's a way to do this, and I'm sure the department probably has a protocol.
They do. I have it right here.
All right. So, it just needs to be followed, is what
you're
saying.
Yeah, it needs to be followed. There's an actual, right. Just like with anything like that, there's an actual organic loading rate table that we're to use. I mean, if you go, here's another one, guideline for in-spring placement of hatchery salmon carcasses for nutrient enrichment. It actually had a pretty good chart, and this is recognized by the WDFW. They're actually cited in it. It says for snook salmon to give it, for one carcass, to use a typical value of 8.5 kilograms. The very next line down, which is 2003 and from WDFW, it says that for over the course of the spawning season should be assessed at 1.9 kilograms per square meter, which is actually much higher than your own documentation. Mm-hmm. But it's still 1.9 kilograms per square meter. If you take a Chinook salmon at 8.5 kilograms for your organic loading, that's
right.
One fish for every, probably 5 square meters.
Right.
So not 2,000 fish for
right.
15 feet area.
All right. Well, I'm glad you brought this to our attention.
Yeah. All righty.
Joe.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Holzmiller, commissioners, we have an arrangement with a private contractor to remove salmon carcasses from our hatcheries and traps, et cetera. And part of that arrangement involves our relationship and working together with regional fishery enhancement groups. And those RFEGs receive funding as a result of egg and carcass sales, and they also take on, you know, per their desire, the distribution of nutrients, the nutrient enhancement program. So in that part of the country, the RFEGs are responsible for doing that, so we'll need to sit down and talk to them and make sure they're doing it right, because this doesn't look right. So we will do that.
Yeah, okay. And actually, if you're curious, I think my friend still has photos from three fishing seasons ago from the same exact thing going on in the same exact location.
I would like to see those.
So I'll talk to my friend and see if I can get them.
I think this is a really good example of you helping us become aware, and then we can deal with this issue, because one picture is worth 1,000 words in here, and I think we understand, but I really appreciate you bringing that to our attention.
Okay, thanks for giving me the opportunity.
So. We will get back on you with you on that. Okay. Thank you, Travis.
Thanks.
So that brings to a close the open public input for this morning.